Waffle
chat
drone.
Waffle
chat drone.
Waffle
chat
chat
drone.
Waffle
chat
chat
drone.
Waffle
chat
drone.
Good day to you, listener, and welcome back to Waffle Chat and Drone. And what an episode we have today. 2020, what a year. What a year. Was it Brexit? Was it COVID? Was it Matt Hancock? Well, Philip, over to you. What have you learned? Give us your first special learning point from 2020.
Oh, the very first special learning point. Well, this is a good one. I think the learning for many, many people would have learned this, that in all of us, there's a barber. Anybody can be a barber. Yes, yes, that's a key learning. I actually managed to outsource to others in the family, and I did discover in fact, I've outsourced my barbering to my wife for many years. I haven't actually been paid for a haircut for, I don't know, nearly 20 years. What I discovered actually is I've got the second best barber in the house, because actually one of the daughters is much better at it than she is. A natural. And I'm very pleased to have given her the opportunity to develop this skill, because who knows, it could be a life skill that she could draw on and make a living off it, maybe in the future, you know, cutting old man's grey hair. All you need, a pair of clippers, a pair of scissors, and a bit of toots bar to have a go. And then, hey presto, you know, that's it. Job done. So, yeah, in everyone, there's a barber.
It's interesting. There's a sort of almost a semi-serious point there, isn't there, about the sort of the obsession with looking good. And does it really matter what your hair looks like? You know, I don't have much hair these days, so it's sort of largely irrelevant from my perspective. So I don't really need a barber.
Well, less is more. I don't like it getting too long. I've got it too long at the minute, and the only reason is because my barber is just disinclined to have a go. You know, I need to book it. Give a many days warning. You can't just sort of wake up in the morning and say, "Oh, could I have a haircut this afternoon?" No, you've got to have many days booked. But yeah, I think less is better.
Well, I used to go to the barber, and actually, when I needed a haircut, which is very rare, I used to ask for a discount. Because I say it's very unfair that, you know, the hair is priced on the basis of a lump sum, rather than, you know, they need to go to output-based pricing or effort-based pricing. And I think,
yes,
I get a lot less value for money. You know, if a haircut is, I don't know, £13-14, you go in and a chap with a lot of hair gets good value for money, gets it there for ages. And then I go in and, you know, 10 seconds later, I'm out. And I think, well, that's just not good in terms of pound per minute of effort. I'm just not getting the expertise.
I've never seen a barber or hairdresser have a sign on the door saying discounts for the bald.
Well, I don't think you. But you, if you know, you don't ask, you don't get, do you? So I started asking. I'd been there a few times, the emphasis on few. And I thought, well, you know, why not? And I'll say, do you give a discount? And I did it sort of fairly jokey way. And he said, yes. So,
okay. Why? Very so good.
Every time I go in now, well, it hasn't been for a long, long time, I say, you know, can I have a discount? Because, you know, there's not much there. You push me through fairly quickly.
So, Andrew, take us forward. What's your first learning point for 2020?
So, my first learning is a very, very big strategic one.
Ooh.
And one of the learnings for me from 2020 is that a Scotch egg constitutes a substantial meal.
Good one.
Oh, yes.
I don't eat Scotch eggs because I don't eat eggs.
Yes.
But it was a surprise to me when I found out that a Scotch egg constitutes a substantial meal.
That was George Eustace under pressure, wasn't it?
This, of course, became a very big issue. When I was one of the tiers, you could only drink alcohol as part, alongside a substantial meal. And there was for weeks there was debate, and it was coming up on the Andrew Marr show and Radio 4, and the papers and letters pages in the papers were full of debate about what constituted a substantial meal. Was it a plate of chips? Was it a bag of crisps? Was it, you know, spaghetti bolognese? But no, a Scotch egg was deemed to be the benchmark. And I think that is a great learning for us going forward.
It is tricky, though, isn't it? Because I think if I were a government minister, I'd say, trust the people. This is common sense. And I must say, actually, I can't decide. And I'm reconciled, actually, on the Scotch egg. I think it depends on the size of the Scotch egg. Because you know you can get those little packs of four in Marks and Spencer, or the very large one. No, I think a large one might constitute a meal, but if I had one of those little ones, that's just a snack, isn't it?
So, Paul, your first one.
Yeah, mine. This might surprise you, but I think tea. Now, I do like a cup of tea. But I think 2020 really brought tea to the fore. Those very stressful moments or moments of social gathering when they were permitted. I think tea, what a wonderful thing. And it reminded me, actually, I don't know if you've ever been in a tank. Have you been in a tank? There's something that marks out...
An army tank.
Yeah, and there's something that marks out the British tank. And it is that you can make a pot of tea. And our tank crews... I love their tanks because they can make a cup of tea. And I think tea is such a wonderful convivial activity. It's quite a festival, isn't it, making a pot of tea.
But we haven't been able to have tea in that environment.
On and off. But, you know, when you get your family together, say, or when you've been through a walk, what could be better than a cup of tea?
Oh, I don't know. I think gallons of gin. Different supply of red wine or beer for me.
Come on, for that, save us. What's your second item?
Okay, my second item is that variety is the spice of life.
Ooh, say more.
I think as we were going through the year and our world shrank, didn't they? We had to stay at home. You had people swapping puzzles in order to try a new one. That went on in the road, people doing that, trying to find new things to do, new things to watch. So I think variety, yes, we like new things, don't we? We like a good variety. And it's when it's taken away, that's when we realise, yeah, that's what we want.
Yes, even if you don't necessarily partake all the time, I think it's the absence of choice and the ability to do it if you wanted to do it, not that you're going to do it all the time. It's just that there is nothing else. So it's nice to think, well, you know, I'd like to go to the garden centre to buy a plant, or just go to the pub for a beer, or just walk round for takeaway fish and chips. And when you can't do any of that, somehow it becomes much more appealing. If something is harder to get hold of, suddenly it becomes much more desirable. Even meeting the in-laws suddenly becomes
desirable. It's out of reach, isn't it?
Well, actually, no, there is a limit.
That's interesting because if...
You can't do the same thing over and over again. I think that's. I mean, I know. You know, it ritual is does save you when you have got you're isolated or little to do. But actually, you need things new stimulus, new horizons, and that was a lesson.
But that's a good one, actually. Maybe that sums up the challenge with lockdowns, that it really removes variety, doesn't it?
Well, remove everything, including variety. Mm. Yes. So I'm going on that note. I'm going to my second one is that I think we realise the importance of sport in two contexts. One is participation.
Good. Yes.
And the second is actually live sport on television. Yes. And in the lockdown when we were confined to our houses, suddenly television got really, really dull, and there were repeats of Last of the Summer Wine and all sorts of stuff. Things weren't being made, so there wasn't really much new stuff coming on. And even some of the comedy shows and chat shows, you know, all went on pause. But I think the one thing that, speaking to other people about last year, you know, one thing that struck me was how much people missed the football on the telly. And then when the football came back and the golf came back and, you know, Formula One, which had a slight pause and then came back, I think, June, July for still a healthy season, but a truncated season. Suddenly the sort of the unpredictability of sport on the television became really quite important. And I think it was missed more than many people expected. And now it's one of the few things that we can really look forward to in the evening. You know, there is usually a football match or there's some sort of sport to watch. The rugby, Six Nations may start in February. There might be the Lions tour. You know, the cricket's been on. The Masters was on in, was it November, a couple of months ago. Yeah, and I think missing that, and then obviously from a participation perspective, I think that's been a major issue. And I hope that the government realises that sport is actually a lot more important than sometimes it gets credit for.
Totally agree with you. I think that links into that variety, that the repeats, they couldn't satisfy. You wanted a new game.
Yes.
You wanted that live, new. It's all very well saying you've seen something before. And they did, on the cricket, they did well. They actually broadcast whole tests from last summer.
Yeah.
In their entirety on the radio, which was quite fun to listen to when we had that hot patch earlier in the year. That was quite fun listening to those. But I think there's comes a time when you're thinking, oh, I've heard this before. Come on, give me something fresh. Mm.
Okay.
Come on, Paul.
Yep. Well, I'm torn because I think what's I've yours? Got some... I'm going to default to the model railway, actually, because the model railway gives you such escapism, and a lot of progress has been made in 2020. I've got one track running now. I've got two laid and not actually powered, but, you know, they really should work. And the other thing about model railway this year is that, you know, the rest of the world was locked down, but the world of my model railway was not. All those little people were still standing around waiting for a train. The drivers were still...
Did you not move them further apart on the platform?
No. You know, the trains still move. There's still a mock fire in the signal box. There's still smoke pouring out of the canal. You know, it's a world of its own. It never suffered COVID. The economy is humming along. No problems at all. Life is good.
Well, apparently Hornby, haven't they had record sales?
Or third increase.
Because people have bought Airfix models, Scale Extric sets. I think the hobby industry has done very, very well as people have turned to often sort of nostalgic or childhood things. In your case, you know, still something as an adult. For most people, something they left decades ago. Yeah, I think that sort of sense of nostalgia and trying to have that sort of link with something comforting has been quite important.
It's pure escapism, but it works really well. And I think, as they say in my local hobby shop, everyone should have a hobby. Everyone should have a hobby. And I think that's something 2020 revealed, it doesn't matter what it is, but something that's a diversion, that's something that takes your mind away, that is yours and only you understand. I think that's really healthy. I think it's a kind of little domain of sanity in a mad world. So
yeah. So how's your ballast laying coming?
Oh, all done. All done. In fact, I've got a
ballast at Staines Junction.
Well, I've got a cold drop area as well. So I've got some coal that I've laid across because my assumption. That's something very interesting, you know. And you'll see if you walk around your local town, something you may have. May or may not have noticed. I bet you haven't noticed it. If you went back to your childhood, just how omnipresent coal must have been. It was everywhere. You probably had a coal bunker in the garden.
Somebody,
some poor unfortunate, would have come down and laid the grate in the morning. You'd have had a coal delivery truck going by. Do you remember the coal delivery trucks?
Yeah, I do remember. Do you remember the sacks being delivered? The very black,
The last railway coal loco left in 68, was it? Something like that. And went later on private railways, industrial railways. So coal was everywhere. And if you look carefully around places like railway stations or industrial areas, you still see the kind of industrial archaeology of coal. Mm. Philip, round to you.
Well, I'm going to continue a little bit of theme, I think, that's been going on. And this is about keeping us occupied. And I think with Andrew's point about sport on TV, I was going to make the point that the general point of TV, not just sport, but just as a pacifier, for the masses, the importance of it, the centrality of it in our lives, because it became the thing, didn't it? And I was going to make the point that it was really important to get sport back on TV, so the populace would have something to occupy their thoughts and be entertained by. This was it, and we do with TV. The whole thing became important. It was like we will. There was a thing about putting on shows, putting on live streaming theatre. Was a big thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We could watch it. Actually, I learned from that watching theatre on TV requires a lot more concentration than just watching standard films or other TV. You really have to stick with it and focus. It's quite draining to watch a play.
Because my conclusion, Philip, was... first of all, I agree. To watch theatre on television, you really have to concentrate. But actually, I ended up thinking, these are just different media, and it just doesn't really work. It's a very, very different creation. And
it is. I think, absolutely. I think that's it did highlight the differences, didn't it, between the two mediums. You know, it's completely quite good. We watched some good stuff, and it will stick in the memory. But I wasn't lining up to see they did it every week, didn't they?
And it's died, hasn't it? Really, mostly.
Yeah, you just couldn't take it. Actually, it was too much. You needed a break in between because they were so dramatic. I like to enjoy it and mull over it. I don't want to just have the next one come along. So it don't need it at a fast pace. But this whole idea of TV, and it's very influential, isn't it? I'm sure the shortages of baking products was inspired by so much baking on TV. And of course, they brought back Bake Off. That they actually made that work as well. It's such an important part of life. I thought the centrality of TV to modern life really shone through.
And so my third one is the seemingly insatiable desire to airbrush history or to revise, or the sort of rise of revisionist history. And, you know, it all started, didn't it? Well, I didn't start, but it was signified by the toppling of Edward Colston, the statue in Bristol, on the 7th of June. And it's a sort of worrying trend that we have to airbrush anything that's bad that's happened in the past out, and we mustn't admit that bad stuff has happened. And suddenly people who lived their lives, rightly or wrongly, by the standards of the time, suddenly get looked at and compared against modern standards, which I think is completely wrong. So you take these people out of context, place them in today's world, and suddenly they look like tyrants or ogres or racists or whatever. And some of them were. A lot of them probably were. But don't you have to measure people by the standards of the day? I mean, it's very tricky, and you can't condone a lot of behaviour in the past, but to try to pretend that it didn't happen and to portray these people in completely different contexts, I just think is wrong. You know, when we have the statue of Winston Churchill having to be protected by police and hoardings put round it, and Charles Dickens and Lord Nelson, some of the nation's great heroes, are now judged because they did certain things, or they married somebody, or they failed to condone or failed to condemn something. I just think this rise in revisionism, I don't know what you call it, political correctness or whatever, I just think it's starting to go too far.
It's a really interesting area, isn't it? I can see quite a lot of sides to this, and it's not a simple one. It's easy, shall I say, to forget the nasty side of people, even ones who've pulled off some great stuff and led us in whatever. It's easy to sort of forget, to downplay, but actually they probably were a nasty bunch, and some of them. So that angle, the angle of, do we have to live, just because someone put up a statue X number of years ago, does that mean we have to have it and walk past it every day? I think that should be questioned. I like the idea of the fourth plinth you've got in Trafalgar Square that is changing. I think that's a good idea. But then I don't like the idea of just going defacing something. I think that's atrocious. You know, I don't think it should be done in an uncontrolled way. I think it should spark a lot of debate about our view of the past and how we celebrate it and commemorate it and mark it. I really do. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I mean, it's not really revisionism, is it? It you could see it almost. It's rewriting history, isn't it? It's kind of denying history.
I under context.
I think that's a very surprised you came up with that one. But interestingly, in a sense, my next one is challenging the same convention. It's, I think, one of the learning points for me was the strength, having the strength and the courage to say, "I don't know." And where I got this from is epidemiology, where throughout the year, really, I've heard so much from ill-informed people who are talking about a very complex subject around lockdown. And what I've started to notice, and I was talking about this to a friend of mine who is an ex-Oxford chemist, and he said to me, you know, what I've noticed is the more people seem to know, the less certain they are. And I was listening to the famous, is it Niall or Neil Ferguson at Imperial the other
Neil
day?
Neil Ferguson, yeah.
And he was asked about schools, should schools go back or not? And he said, this isn't a direct quote, but he said something like, well, I'm not sure. I'm not certain that we can fix this in any material way if schools go back. But I thought, well, you know, there's a guy with such superior knowledge to someone like myself or any of the newspaper observers. And he's really saying, I don't know. And if I contrast that.
Sorry to interrupt there, but I'm not sure that that's ever happened before with Neil Ferguson. I think you've got to be very, very careful about holding Neil Ferguson up as a guy.
Well, no, but that's
superior knowledge to anybody.
Well, that's what he said. And it was based, you know, that's what he said. And certainly his modelling, he has always caveated his modelling with key assumptions. He's not said this is what's going to happen. He's certainly scared people who perhaps didn't know any better, but he has never said this is what will happen. So my point is that there's a time to be able to say, I don't know. Very often the people who know the most are those, I think, who are most confident in being able to say, I don't know. And I think there's a lesson for us all, actually, because this leaping to a conclusion is a very dangerous thing. And there are so many issues when I see, you know, journalists, TV broadcasters, all sorts of people expressing opinions. And they, well, Michael Gove comes to mind, you know, we've had enough of experts. Well, you know, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And we should allow ourselves time to reflect, to understand and accept that there are some things that are of value judgment, and it may be better to leave it to the experts.
Well, I think but that's an important point on its own, that the experts are expert in their particular field. They're not experts at dealing with necessarily something that's far more complicated, what you call the bigger picture. So you get the health officials whose sole mission is to preserve health and restrict loss of life. Mm. And then you have the economists who will give their opinions about damage to the business community and the loss of jobs. And then you have the educationalists who will talk about the damage to you know, to children and students and education generally. But they come at it from one angle, and I think that's a bit of a problem. It's just, as you say, it's not dissimilar from the previous conversation that we had. But experts are experts in their field. But what you cannot do is pluck one expert and say, that is the solution, and that is the only thing that we should do and the only path that we should follow. And in many ways, that I think it showed. You know, the last year has shown the danger of that, the extreme views and the reliance on experts. And actually the politicians are in a very difficult place because they have lots and lots of inputs in a changing situation, which is almost unprecedented. But they have to take all of the advice, and they should be taking all of the advice. And I think the problem has come when they focus on one or two pieces of advice from a narrow cohort of experts. You know, Sage, for instance, is largely medical experts. Well, they're inputting into government policy. Where are all the other experts who are looking at the bigger picture and collateral damage of sort of lockdown strategy? That it should all inform government government decision making.
So true.
I think we should move on to Philip's number two in his hierarchy.
Yeah, it's my number two from the top. We've got some heavy stuff going on, haven't we? I think we're getting into it, and this sort of fits into some of the discussion. That my second most important lesson here is that the realization, I think, is a community level, working level, personal level, that really you don't have to continue as we've done before. Change is possible. Significant, dramatic change is possible. It may not be desirable, but it really is possible. And I think that's what this year has shown. The working from home and so on, it just really show what's feasible in working that way. Many people would have poo-pooed and said no and would take years and years. It just happened quite dramatically. And I think the whole national agenda, community agenda, what it does with its money may not be great, but you can really do dramatic things in quite short order. And I think people are reviewing their personal lives and thinking, yeah, I can make dramatic changes. And I think it's kind of awoken that... challenged the assumption that it's very difficult to change. I think this is going to have reverberations for a long time to come when it comes to all policy discussions and all sorts, that actually, you can have big changes. It is possible.
Mm. I think it'll be very interesting to see which one of those changes do endure. And people talk about getting back to old normal, or, I want normal back. Well, I don't think we'll ever get back to old normal. I think old normal has changed. I think you're absolutely right. There are certain things, such as working from home, that have probably changed forever. Retail, obviously, and online and all that sort of stuff. But it'll be very interesting in a few years' time to see which patterns we've sort of fallen back into, or which habits we've fallen back into.
Mm.
Like travel. Will this obsession with travelling and going on holiday to sort of places like Cambodia or Thailand or Australia and the jets and the pollution that is generated, will that change? Will people just go back to their old habits, or will they think, I don't need to do all of that? Actually, Cornwall is quite nice, and the Lake District and Suffolk and we've got a lot of nice places in the UK, or even on our doorstep in Europe. So I think you're right. I think forcing that change will make most people to reevaluate.
They will, but it is what do we do about their next problem, let's say? And rather than sort of being, oh well, it's the way it is and there's not much we can do about it, I think actually it's changed. No, actually, yeah, you can. We can do a lot about things. We can actually be quite dramatic. And I think it's shown what's feasible, and that will change the discussion when it comes to other aspects.
Mm. And, do you think it's made people more resilient or less resilient?
I'm not sure it's about resilience. It's just willing to entertain a different way of living, a different way of doing. Willing. I think that there was just this unwillingness to do it. There was just like, oh, we can move a little bit away from where we are. It's very difficult. Oh, maybe. But actually, no. You can make big strides. Mm. You really can.
Mm. No, I went to a thing a little while ago with a French expert on change, and his line was, people in corporations always talk about how difficult it is to drive change, and he said, and they always blame people won't change, and he said, actually, all the serious evidence is that people are incredibly adaptable. What is difficult to change is institutional behavior, processes, systems, and so on, but people are fine. People are incredibly adaptable, which I thought, it stays with me. I think it's true. And if you look at say change in direction on climate change, for example, which seems now to be really getting traction, that's another manifestation, isn't it?
Well, for my top two, I actually had three for my top two, which is a bit sort of counterintuitive.
Cheeky.
So the one I dropped out was the, because I'm not sure it's a 2020 thing, it's probably a little bit more enduring than that, was the danger of China. My second one is that basically that humans cannot control nature. Nature will always win out. And, you know, obviously the virus and climate change are two very obvious examples. And for all our technological innovations and our advancements in science and medicine, nature will always win. We can't bend the planet to our particular desires or our particular needs. But nature will find a way round it somehow. And you could get quite philosophical about this, and you could think, well, you know, there's the virus sent to control the human race, which is just getting it out of, you know, just a bit above itself. There are too many of them on the planet now. You know, there's no other species that would behave in the way that we have. So do we need putting back in our box? Has nature found, it's the ultimate artificial intelligence machine, and it will invent something. Because the more medicines that we create, the more virulent nature will make its next virus. It's a continual battle. We will never win because we're always trying to catch up. It's like the cyber. It's like the hackers and the cyber experts. They have to protect everything and they're always catching up with the latest techniques. Nature will always win. And, you know, the climate change thing is a very, very good example. It will get to a point where human life is no longer sustainable. Because there is not enough land, there's not enough fertile soil. The ice caps have melted, seas have risen, and we will not be able to continue, you know, unless we do something quite dramatic. And nature's going to win that battle. There is no way that we can win the battle unless we rein ourselves in.
So when you say nature, what do you mean? Do you mean, you know, green leaf trees and plants and insects
It's everything. It's all that sort of it's the planet, the way the planet has been constructed, the interlinking of everything. You know, we're destroying all these species, all these plants and everything, and they all have a function somewhere. You take one out and it has an impact elsewhere. And we're just seeing we're starting to see the effects of that now, the food and the interruption on the food chain. So I sort of see nature as this whole sort of the ecosystem within which we are a very small part, but we're in danger of being seen as a wasp and being squashed by this the ultimate AI machine.
It's rather like the Borg in Star Trek. Did you ever follow Star Trek? The Borg was.
I did the early one.
Yeah, the Borg was quite an interesting creation. It was this kind of concept, but artificial being, and to challenge it, its response was to make you part of it, and it was this unstoppable force, which is something akin to the nature you describe, because of course we are part of nature, aren't we? So we're.
I think you've been describing what one might describe summarize as the Gaia paradigm or the Gaia principle. You know, this is James Lovelock came up with this theory that the Earth and is a sort of system that will balance, self-regulate itself. So, and it'll always perpetuate the conditions for life. You know, whatever happens, it'll come back to it. I have a feeling that he himself actually moved away from agreeing that was the case.
Well, that's a good one, Andrew. You brought us, certainly generating the big stuff. Wasn't really what I'd expected. Great, so I'm going
to
bring us.
I've got a bigger one to come, don't worry.
Well, I'm going to bring us down to earth. I think the newspaper subscription, the full newspaper description, where you get it delivered to your doorstep early in the morning, I think that's immensely valuable. The reason is I think it gives you a window on the world. I think television news is these days. It's based on sound bites, really. It tends to be very superficial. In programs that we used to know, like Horizon or Panorama, there are exceptions, like sites Channel 4 News or Newsnight, but I'm normally dozed off by the time Newsnight is on. But I think a good newspaper does give you a window on the world. And the other thing I'd say for it, you might say, well, get a digital subscription, which, of course, many of us do, and I have some. But
well, I think you do certainly come across stuff that you probably wouldn't normally read online, because online is like online shopping. If you know what you want, you can go ahead and get it, and it's very easy. But actually where it falls down is the stuff that you don't necessarily want to seek out, but actually is very interesting. And as you thumb through your newspaper, and you probably read all sorts of snippets and stories and the world news and then the commentary and then some art stuff, which you probably wouldn't actually go onto a website and seek.
So. Yeah, another interesting characteristic I've read of printed news journals of any form is that in the printed form, I reckon about 80% of it is read, typically. The digital form, it's less than 20%. It's a fundamentally different experience. And I still, I don't know if I'm alone, but...
Well, it gets perused, should we say. It gets perused. And I know we can all remember having great experience with newspaper, and I certainly enjoyed broadsheets and flicking through them and reading various stories. But I would say on the and every day, no. There were quite a lot of days where disappointment, really, is that story and not really, you know, start a little bit and then move on to another one. There are times when you find some cracking stuff. So I'm not absolutely convinced. It's sort of like a bit of the heyday of the paper. I was going to say, do you think the heyday of the paper has actually been now? Is it past?
Well, I use my newspapers to make fire bricks to keep me warm in the winter, and you can't do that with a digital news channel, I have to say. I think we should move on. I'm intrigued, rather than talking about fire bricks. I'm interested in Philip. We're getting to the crunch now.
Well, this is controversy now. I can see it's very interesting, this discussion. As we've been carrying on, I've been thinking, God, this is all. We are either going to end up in fisticuffs here. My top lesson from 2020 is that we are living in the age of science. Yes, I know we've had a bit of discussion about science-led decision-making or not and all that kind of stuff, but I think without a doubt, I think this year has proven that the scientific process is invaluable and that it works. There's no two way. You could not dream up a vaccine. You can't imagine it. You can't just sort of take a stroll and sort of spot one in the wild. You have to have incredible knowledge acquired over many, many decades of thorough and systematic study and research in order to get to where we are. And it's absolutely this has proven it. The scientific process. We are in the age of science, no doubt about it.
You could say that there is a natural solution as well, and I think good science is immensely valuable and improved all of our lives immeasurably. And I think it's illustrated by the fact that since March, a number of organisations of pharmaceutical companies have come up with the vaccines and the scientists, an incredible effort. But the sort of the human element hasn't been able to keep up with the science, and we've had this sort of blunt instrument of lockdown and suppression, and we've had no other nuanced approach. So whereas science has come up with some amazing theories and amazing discoveries, from a human perspective, all we can come up with, the only creative idea, is to lock people away in their dwellings.
Well, no, it's the politicians who are ill-equipped who have come up with those ideas. They are ill-equipped. That's my argument. No real understanding of it and grasp of it.
What can we conclude from this, though? And I'm thinking, on the one hand, I think we live in an age of science. You could be accused of just stating a truism or telling us the obvious. But what I'm interested in is the implications of what you're saying, which is it that we've only now realised, or that we're in an age of science as a collective, as a society, or is it that we should be better at managing our scientific understanding and capability? And so, for example, Prime Minister educated in the classics, and a cabinet, I think most of them actually are ancient historians or classicists or similar. I've got a very traditional British education. That's an ill fit. That's not a good model.
Yes, I think that it's brought it home that our ruling set are just not the right. They've not got the right experience, the right knowledge, the right expertise, the right viewpoint. They're not.
I think you're onto something there.
So, well, where we got to there? Where have we got to now? Is it Paul? Are you?
Is it? Well, mine.
Or is it? No, Andrew.
It's your turn, Andrew.
Yeah, so I'm going to come across in potentially. We'll see how this one lands.
Oh dear.
So, for me, one of the big learnings of 2020 is that I think that society has become too intolerant of death. And that death, other than being the only certainty after birth, is now seen as something that is unacceptable. And because we don't accept death and embrace it, we fight against it. And it was very interesting earlier in the week when Jonathan Sumption QC got into a spot of bother and some controversy when he was talking about the quality of life, and his theory was that not all lives are equal. And then you hear from others, and there was a doctor on the panel when he was speaking who said, all lives are equal, no life is worth more or less than any other life. And I can see both sides of the story, because lives aren't all equal. And there are people who are still alive who don't really have inequality of life. And I think at times we allow the emotional side to outweigh the sensible side. But it just seems to me that as a society, it is now no longer acceptable to say this is not a life worth leading, and we have to prolong it at all costs. And the last years has shown that very, very visibly, where the entire agenda has been about saving life and not about some of the collateral damage, which actually also indirectly is about saving life and the massive consequences of some of the policy. It's very difficult to get the balance right. But in a situation like we had in 2020, bad stuff is going to happen. There is no good outcome. So bearing in mind it is a bad situation, how do you therefore choose to steer your path through it?
It's a really good discussion, isn't it, about our attitude towards death. I do agree. I remember going to America and working over there and watching the TV, and advert after advert after advert was about healthcare. You had to come away thinking this country is obsessed by living forever. And I do believe that is you're absolutely right. There is totally an agenda and a hope to live forever, and there are various people trying to work on finding the recipe for eternal life. What mix of drugs you can take, and conquering these things. And it's happened. And you could say we are softer, aren't we? We don't live with death. How many people in our community do we know that's died? Very few, isn't it? I'm sure you go back not many decades, and you're far more familiar with it. So yes, we're uncomfortable. We are less comfortable with it.
Well, it becomes abhorrent to accept it. And you know, there are lots of people with sort of very limited cognitive ability, and you know, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and other diseases that affect them. But we're continuing to keep them alive. The problem is it's very sad. It's very emotional, but we're almost making a bigger problem, because it will happen. You know, they will pass away at some point. So we will feel emotional. We'll feel sad.
We don't like the idea of people dying before their time. We find early deaths, premature deaths, that is not comfortable. We're not happy with that. And that's where if we're sad and emotional, it is those kind of deaths that we take note of. I think that life expectancy is when we see a 90-year-old or a 100-year-old. I'm sure many of us sort of think, God, that can't be long, can it? You know, and we don't really think they should last another 10 years. But I do think that premature death, people dying in their 30s, 40s, 50s, even the 60s now, and even in the 70s now, we're beginning to think that that's actually unnecessary. I think it's the intolerance by the wealthy of death And actually, all this idea of protecting it is really driven by people in power and people with money who want to be protected. Because there's not an intolerance of suffering.
Hmm. Yeah, I was heading in similar... Yeah,
absolutely. I'm not saying intolerance of suffering.
Because the rich don't suffer. Hmm. That's why we're not... There's no agenda, there's no thing to end poverty and end things. Hmm. It's about ending death from COVID, yeah. Because I think the powerful don't want to die.
I'm going to have to save you. I'm going to have to intervene.
You're going to have to bring us okay, your
so
top
I'm going to intervene and say,
I
think the big learning point of 2020 was the power of the USB cable. The USB cable, that's your window on the world. That's your means of communication. That's your source of learning. It's your source of communication in all ways. It's how you get your groceries ordered. That's where it's at.
We've gone from one extreme to the other.
That's fantastic.
So, gentlemen, what's your favourite? What's the big learning point from 2020?
Oh, God. Too many. That's a very difficult one.
We'll conclude then and say the most important learning point is indeed the importance of the USB cable. Thank you, Mr. USB. So from Waffle Chat and Drone Listener, thank you for joining us. So thank you and goodbye.